Professor Strauss, Philosophy of Plato, March 29, 1965, Session 1.
We'll begin. Now, let us begin at the beginning. We make one assumption. This is not entirely clear, but this is generally accepted. Namely, that students of political science should have some knowledge of the history of political philosophy. Now, such knowledge is supplied in a general survey course on the history of political philosophy. But some of you wish to have a more detailed or more exact knowledge than can be supplied in such a course, a less global and more specialized knowledge. I offer, therefore, every second year a course on Plato's political philosophy. Now, Plato has presented his political philosophy in such a way that a report about it is particularly inadequate or unsatisfactory. I shall not repeat now what I have said often in class, but I have now stated it in print. In The City and Man, the first 16 pages of the chapter on Plato's Republic, and I ask you to read that. I give, therefore, the course on Plato's political philosophy in the form of an interpretation of a single Platonic dialogue. The first choice would naturally be the Republic, but the Republic has one great effect. It is very long, and therefore I prefer a shorter dialogue. The last time, when I lectured on Plato's philosophy, I selected the Gorgias. On these grounds, the Gorgias leads up to the a question which is in a way the broadest of all questions. I mean, how should a man live? And the answer given is generally the philosophic life is the right life. But in the Gorgias, the philosophic life is said to be the truly political life. Or rather, Socrates claims that he is the only true political man, statesman, in Athens. This is subject of the Gorgias is rhetoric, and rhetoric is asserted to be not an art, but a flattery, a kind of flattery, a sham. Every sham art is a spurious imitation of a genuine art, and Socrates suggests this too. There are feeling in the body and are feeling in the soul. And that is one which is called gymnastics for the body and medicine. And to see the medicine. Building up a healthy body, gymnastics. Restoring health when lost, medicine. Similarly, there are two arts here. One is called the legislative art, which is said to correspond to language, and another which is called, let me say, the punitive art. The Greek word used to the term of justice in the sense of vindictive justice. And this is punishment, you know, punishment being a kind of medicine for the soul. Now, these two together are called the political art. So that is, there is no common name for the two arts of the body. And now we come to the corresponding sham art, cosmetics here, which means that it is the appearance of a healthy body by all kinds of things. And the medicine, that is the art of cooking, poultry cooking. You see, there also a farm. And here, coffee, see? And corresponding to that is crackling. That is the tuna, the very ambiguous tuna, which is what is proposed in the garden. Now, this implies that sophistry, however bad it may be, is in itself higher or at least less ignoble than rhetoric, just because it is a positive, corresponds to the positive thing. Now, this must make us interested in the question of what sophistry is. Sophistry is the subject of the dialogue Protagoras. And to the Protagoras, I decided to devote this course. At any rate, the Protagoras and the Gorgias, that is my premise, seem to belong together in the same way in which sophistry and rhetoric belong together. There is, I believe, another speech here. Now, before turning to the Protagoras, I propose to summarize the chief results of my fall 1953 course on the Gorgias. And I have to devote to this subject as a summary at least two meetings, perhaps three. Now, the Gorgias consists of three clearly separated paths. And in this respect, as well as in some other respects, it reminds us of the Republic. The Republic, you will recall, consists of the father-son part, the discussion of Sugaris with Cephalos and his son Polemachos, then of the Thrasymachos part, and then of the two brothers part, the bulk of the verse, the discussions with Glaucon and Adamantus. Correspondingly, the Gorgias consists of three parts, the discussion with Gorgias, Gorgias being the most famous orator, with Koulos, and with Callicles. The Callicles section is by far the largest, and at first glance the most important, just as in the Republic, the Glaucon Adamantus section is by far the largest, and at first glance the most important. Gorgias and Koulos are foreign teachers of rhetoric, Poulos being Gorgias' young adherent. Callicles is a young Athenian about to enter politics. This all corresponds to the Republic. Cephalos and Polemachos are not Athenian citizens, are metics, and Thrasymachos is of course a foreign teacher of rhetoric, and Glaucon and Adamantus are Athenians, just as Callicles is Athenian. The dialogue begins with the words of Callicles, quote, war and battle, unquote. No other dialogue begins that way. This indicates that the dialogue is very emphatically polemical, fighting. Sugaris attacks rhetoric, and therewith the political life is ordinarily practiced with the utmost radicalism. The opposition between the philosophic life and the political life as ordinarily understood is the theme of the dialogue Gorgias. Now, the dialogue Gorgias is furthermore, and I ask you again to read the 16 pages I wrote about the Platonic dialogue in general, and I make tacit use of these remarks here. The dialogue Gorgias is a voluntary dialogue. Well, perhaps I explain this briefly. And there is, among the many differences among the dialogues, there is one which is of some importance between voluntary and compulsory dialogue. A compulsory dialogue is a dialogue into which Sugaris is compelled for sheer decency, as though he dislikes it. For example, his dialogue with the Athenian demons on the occasion of his accusation is truly a compulsory dialogue. But the Charmides is perhaps the most simple example of a dialogue which is voluntary, so as being back from a battle, the war, rushes to the gymnasium where the most gifted boys of Athens are, and is so pleased to be back to his favorite home, voluntarily. Now the gorgeous is a voluntary dharma. So that it is easier to speak with gorgeous. He goes to the building where gorgeous lives. He's accompanied by his companion Chaerephon, the same man who went to Delphi to ask the god whether there is anyone wiser than Socrates. But Chaerephon has kept him back on the marketplace so that they miss Gorgias' exhibition of his art. When he hears that they have come too late, Chaerephon expresses his willingness to repair the damage which he had caused. He is a friend of Gorgias, which means he is closer to Gorgias than Socrates is. But Socrates does not wish to hear, to listen to an exhibition of Gorgias' art, to one of his show speeches for which Gorgias was so famous. Socrates wants to find out from Gorgias what the power of his art is, and secondly, what claim Gorgias raises regarding his teaching, meaning whether Gorgias believes that he can convey the power of his art to his pupils. Now this conversation about why Socrates comes and why they came too late takes place outside of the building in which Gorgias stays. When they have entered the building and see Gorgias, Socrates asks Chaerephon to ask Gorgias about his art. Again, Chaerephon is closer to Gorgias than Socrates is. Polos asks Chaerephon to address the question to him, because Gorgias is tired, he has made his long speech. We draw from this a provisional conclusion that Gorgias is not at the peak of his condition. He is tired. We do not get a full and adequate picture of this famous man. Now, Polos answers to Chaerephon, implies that the good life is a life in accordance to art. Art in the old sense, craft, handicraft. And art is understood here in contradistinction to chance. To live according to art, to thought, to order, to rule, is better than to live at random. And the best life is a life in accordance with the art of rhetoric. Now Socrates is dissatisfied with his answer. He says Polos has not sufficiently practiced the art of dialectics, but practiced too much the art of rhetoric. Polos has praised rhetoric as a wonderful thing, but he has not said what rhetoric is. Dialectics, that is the alternative to rhetoric here, would tell us what rhetoric is. Blaming and praising is the state of rhetoric. Saying what a thing is dialectic. Does this distinction between rhetoric and dialectics remind you of something with which you are familiar outside of theater and present-day discussion? To say that rhetoric is best is a rhetorical statement. To define rhetoric is a dialectical statement. Yes? Yeah, in other words, that is very true. The distinction between rhetoric and dialectics has something to do with the present-day distinction between science and non-science. But it is, there is something to that, but still it is misleading. The two distinctions are not identical. Why? Because according to Sugarist, if you have first to know what rhetoric is before you blame it or praise it. But when you know what it is, you know also its rank, and therefore whether it's very noble, medium noble, not very noble or ignoble. So it is not, but there is a certain kindred indeed. Sugarist asked Frank Gordon to answer the question of what the power of his art is. But he should give a brief answer. Now, this has to do again with the distinction between rhetoric and dialectic, because the rhetorician as such is a maker of long speeches. The dialectician, on the other hand, is a maker of short speeches. What did you say? Say it again. On what ground? Yeah. This is a maker of short speeches. Now, because in dialectic, every step can be carefully considered. And whereas in rhetoric speech, what is so important is the overall effect of the whole speech, especially on the passion. Now, Gorgias claims to be a perfect master of speech, i.e. to be as good at making short speeches as at making long speeches. And therefore he says, of course, I will oblige you. I will make a short speech. Now this is another handicap of God. The first handicap was that he is tired out from his long speech. The second, that he is compelled to give short answers. And the consequence of this, and another handicap which we will see soon, is that he is unable to state his case for rhetoric, and for his rhetoric in particular. Now, I'm sure there are quite a few among you who say, what does this strange comedy mean? And what is the interest of it for us? A perfectly legitimate question, but which I cannot answer now. I mean, either you have a certain confidence that I'm not, a business, no, how do you call it, a comedian? Show business. Or you have not. Let it have all that. Now, God has answered. First, rhetoric is an art that has to do with speeches. But so where he says, all arts have to do with speeches. For example, medicine has to do with speeches about health, doesn't it? All speeches deal with some subject matter. An art dealing with speeches which do not deal with subject matter does not exist. Tries to get out of this fix by saying that, yes, but some arts proceed chiefly through manual work and it can be practiced in silence, without speech, whereas others proceed chiefly or solely through speech. An extreme example, arithmetic speech. Then you can, of course, also figure silently, but the actual work is a speaker when you speak to yourself. Whereas the work of a sculptor, his art is practiced silently. He doesn't have to figure as speaking. Rhetoric is one of the arts which proceeds chiefly through speeches. But say it must have subject matter. That simple. The subject matter are the greatest and best of human affairs. But what are these greatest and best of human affairs? Is not the health the most important thing, or strength, or wealth? Now, Sugarist argues this out in one form which is to be called a dialogue within the dialogue. In other words, he makes the physician speak. in favor of health being the greatest thing. He makes the gymnastic teacher speak in favor of strength or beauty being the best thing. And he makes the money maker speak in favor of wealth being the best thing. This means, in this dialogue within a dialogue, which is a very common occurrence in Platonic dialogues, has here forever a special meaning, a special purpose. And this, by the way, is a general rule. There are a limited number of devices which Plato used. One is used, one for some dialogue within the dialogue. But this may have a very different function in different contexts. Now, in this context, the function of the dialogue within the dialogue is to show Gorgias his competitor. Gorgias says, I teach the most important thing. And then he shows him, say, the teacher of medicine, who lays away the same thing. By showing, by reminding Gorgias of his competitors, he adds a third predicament to the two which we have already seen, his tiredness and the compulsion to speak his brief answer. A general lesson from this. Socrates does these things, for example, the dialogue within the dialogue showing his competitors. Socrates himself uses rhetoric, because these are rhetorical devices, or his dialectic, as used here, is rhetorical, is a mixture of dialectics and rhetoric. And if we may make a big jump, in no way borne out by what I said now, but a kind of hypothesis, the Gorgias, whatever it may do regarding rhetoric, exhibits Socrates' rhetoric, which is in no way the theme of the dialogue, but it exhibits it indeed. Now we are still confronted with this question. What are the greatest human things? What is happiness? And Gorgias says the good which rhetoric produces is in truth the greatest good and the cause of both freedom and ruling over others in one's city. For rhetoric enables a man to persuade people by speeches in political assemblies and thus to control the physician, the gymnastic teacher, the moneymaker, or whoever may be competitor of the rhetorician. We may say rhetoric is the art of persuading political assemblies about politically relevant matters. That is surely true, but it does not go very deep. Socrates continues as follows. You say rhetoric persuades, but does not the mathematician too persuade? We must make a distinction between teaching and persuading. Rhetoric does not teach, that's mathematics teaching, it only persuades. Now while this exchange goes on, there occurs a shift of emphasis to one particular kind of rhetoric, forensic rhetoric, the rhetoric practiced before law courts, the kind of rhetoric which is concerned with just and unjust things as such, and which concerns the individual who accuses or is accused. And here in this context, the impression is created that just and unjust things are the sole theme of rhetoric. Now, after Socrates has led Gorgias to this point, the very leading of which Gorgias is blissfully unaware, he leads him again to political rhetoric proper, to what the Greeks call deliberative rhetoric. That is what is going on in the assembly where you decide about laws, peace and war and so on. With an explicit reference to the potential students in the audience, because there are many people around, Socrates induces Gorgias to reveal the immense power of rhetoric. The immense power of rhetoric. Every ambitious youth in the audience, potential tyrant, so to speak, must become Gorgias' pupil. If Gorgias succeeds in showing that without my training you will never succeed in the arena. It just is today one could get, in this country one could get, maybe case you have to go to law school and back to this or that law school if you want to be highly successful. Some people would also say through political science departments, but at this moment it seemed to be clear that being trained by Gorgias could be the best way of becoming an outstanding leader. The answer of Gorgias can be reduced to this simple proposition. Rhetoric is quasi-omnipotent. He tells a number of examples what rhetoricians have achieved, both in private life and in public life. In private life, as he gives the example, his brother was a physician, and could not persuade a patient to take a bitter pill. But he, the rhetorician, Gorgias, succeeded, was a physician completely failed. And so you see how eminently powerful rhetoric is. So after having made clear how powerful rhetoric is, he can't help disregarding the drawbacks of that very power. Because it is so powerful, it is naturally feared and distrusted. And therefore the teachers of rhetoric are in danger of being expelled from the city and even killed. The implication of that, and Gorgias says that, is very deplorable. Because every art can be misused. I mean, a gymnastic teacher, for example, wants to teach the boy so that he will be a good soldier later on, etc. But if this boy hits his father, you can't blame the gymnastic teacher for that. Similarly, if a student of rhetoric misuses his art, that's not the fault of the professor of rhetoric, and he must not be blamed for that. In brief, rhetoric can be used unjustly, but it ought not to be used unjustly. In itself, it is as just as gymnastics, which also can be misused. Now, so let's go then as follows. What does the power of rhetoric then mean? The orator is superior to the expert, to the knower. For example, to the physician. Especially in persuading crowds, i.e. ignoramus, he himself being also an ignoramus. Let us say that it is a matter of weaponry. And the experts have a certain opinion. Let us assume that the experts are not split. But the experts have no power of persuading crowds. I mean, they can talk to other experts. So there must be someone who has no knowledge, but only some information given to him by the experts, and he talks, he is an ignoramus, he talks to ignoramus, and that's right. This is not a denial of the power of rhetoric, of course, but only a spelling out of what that power means. Ultimately, the power of rhetoric has to do with the superior bodily power of a large mass of ignoramus over the small minority of non-ignoramus. Yet, Socrates proceeds to question the power of rhetoric itself by raising six questions. Is the orator also ignorant of the just and unjust, the base and noble, the good and bad? What about that? Must your pupil, Gorgias, know these things before you teach him how to speak? Or do you teach him the just and unjust things, etc., while you teach him to speak, how to speak? Gorgias, this Olympian sovereignty, says, if he doesn't happen to know these things, which so to speak every side knows, I will teach them to him too. But Socrates says, the man who has learned the music thing, now you listen carefully, becomes a musical man. I must try to express something in English which is not so easily expressible in English. A man who has learned the horsic thing from horse becomes a horseman, a horsic man. In Greek, that is very simple. Now we come to the key point. A man who has learned the just thing, does he not become a just man? God says yes. And why he says yes is a very great riddle, but the fact is undeniable. Hence, Socrates concludes, the orator will never act unjustly or misuse his power, because he knows the just thing. But he who knows the just thing is just. Hence he will never act unjustly, never misuse his rhetoric. This conclusion should make Gorgias very attractive to decent Athenians, as the rhetoric as taught by Gorgias cannot possibly be used for any bad purpose. To that extent, Gorgias is friend, so that he's friendly to Gorgias. He says, look what a paragon there is here. He is not only a marvelous teacher of rhetoric, he teaches a rhetoric which can never be used for any unjust purpose. But Socrates is not quite so philanthropic. He points out to Gorgias that he has said the contrary before, and he says rhetoric can be misused. In a word, the result is that Gorgias does not know how rhetoric is related to justice. There is an explicit self-contradiction, which is quite clear. Rhetoric may be, the rhetorician may be unjust, and therefore, since people know that, he is in danger. Yeah? They don't trust him. The alternative is that the rhetorician cannot be unjust. Hence, he will not be in danger. Does it not follow? There's no one mistrusts him. But you can also put an implicit self-contradiction. Again, the first phrase is quite clear. The rhetorician may be unjust, therefore he is in danger. But the rhetorician is omnipotent. Hence, he is not in danger. He can handle every accusation. People may distrust him as much as they want. They may accuse him of a capital crime. He will never be condemned, and he will always prove his superiority because of the tremendous power of rhetoric. But if he is omnipotent, it is of course safe for him to be unjust. He is safe especially through foreign rhetoric. Yeah, because the trust leads to accusations. So, now we have then here this, and this leads us into a somewhat diverse trade-off. Gorgias greater suggests that there is an rhetoric is omnipotent. But so, and this is commonsensically a non-absurd thing, of course, but still, there is something implied in it. In a way, Socrates says also a certain omnipotence. When he says, he who knows the just thing is just, knowledge guarantees justice. It's also a kind of omnipotence of peace. And this we can say is what Socrates and Gorgias, these two antagonists, share a certain view according to which there is an omnipotence of peace. That they have in mind different kinds of peace is true. But by the way, if someone regards the thesis omnipotence of speech or preponderant power of speech as absurd, think of the many people who say today that the truth must win out in the end. They have heard it often. Reason must eventually win. That's exactly the point which we are concerned. If there is such a preponderant and the extreme case of omnipotence of logos, which is both speech and reason. The result of this very short conversation between Socrates and Gorgias is that Gorgias is knocked out. Polus, who is not tired out, rises in his defense. He disapproves of Socrates' procedure. Socrates raised an improper question. Namely the question whether the rhetorician must know the just thing. This is the kind of question which one doesn't raise in our circles. You can easily find a contemporary parallel for that. I could even, if I had looked it up, give you indicated case and the volume of the megabytes by the year. Where this accusation was made when I had made a certain statement about a certain school, I was accused. This kind of thing is not to be said, that is irrelevant in a thing. According to Polus, Gorgias was ashamed to say no, and so, then he should have said yes, and so he got into trouble. Now, Polus, who is much younger, and not exhausted, tries to turn the table on Socrates by now becoming the questioner, because he has seen that this Olympian thing in Gorgias, I can answer all questions, is a very dangerous thing. And that in a way, the humble man who doesn't answer questions, only asks questions, is tactically in a much better position. And so he tried to imitate Socrates. But there is, of course, a different situation, because Socrates had never claimed that he is able to answer all questions. And therefore, it's a question from a difference. Socrates denies now, in the exchange with Polus, what he had not denied in talking to Gorgias, namely that rhetoric is an art. He says now it is merely a knack acquired by experience which produces some grace and pleasure. Yes, as they what a comedian on the stage does. He knows that this kind of jokes on this occasion will hit and so on. Socrates doesn't know whether his view of rhetoric applies to Gorgias' kind of rhetoric, for Gorgias' art has not become clear, and therefore one does know. Gorgias' view of rhetoric and Gorgias' rhetoric itself are not revealed in the dialogue called after him. That is a must. So when he starts his view of rhetoric, states his view of rhetoric to Gorgias, but with the understanding that he will discuss this view not with Gorgias, but with Polus. Polus will be used as a kind of guinea pig. to bring to light Socrates' view. But Godhead, as it were, is silent. Only listen. Godhead's reaction to it will also not come out. Neither Godhead's view of rhetoric, nor his view of Socrates' rhetoric, will come out thematically. This is external character of the dialogue. Now, Socrates' definition of rhetoric, I have already indicated in that schema. A rhetoric is a kind of a part of flattery. Flattery is directed toward seeming well-being of body and soul, whereas the arts are directed toward the true well-being of body and soul. In other words, flattery aims at the most pleasant, whereas the arts aim at the best. Furthermore, arts are able to give an account, a logos, of what they are doing. The shoemaker, when you watch him, can tell you why he makes this move or that. Whereas the flatteries are unable to give an account of what they are doing. Now this is what Socrates develops at great length. There are of course great difficulties here. For example, can there not be an art dealing with flesh, with the pleasant, or at least dealing also with the pleasant? Is, for example, the physician not concerned also with inflicting the minimum of pain, or maybe even giving the maximum of pleasure to his patient while operating on him, etc.? Good. I mentioned one more point. The legislative art produces genuine health of the soul. Justice restores genuine health of the soul. Justice is here understood as an art. I cannot help this difficulty. This whole schema seems to imply that the legislative art is the highest form of human knowledge, because it is one which makes the human soul perfect. Okay. What the relation of the legislative art to philosophy or to a dialectic is obscure. It is possible that philosophy or dialectics are here simply disregarded in this, or abstracted from in this schema. Now, Polus is of course shocked by the suggestion that rhetoric should not be an art, but only something as low as cosmetics, or even lower than. If, and he argues as follows, if rhetoric were a kind of flattery, i.e. a low thing, the orators would not have power, the power in the city which they actually have. In other words, Polus tries to show that rhetoric is an art by showing its power. According to him, rhetoric has the power which tyrants have, which incidentally implies that rhetoric is essentially unjust, because it is understood that tyrants are essentially unjust. Now, but to follow his argument more precisely, according to Polus, tyrants have also power in the city. But can one say that the tyrants, they think the tyrants are very powerful, they have an art, that there is such a thing as a tyrannical art? This is at least a question. Polus somehow does not consider that. At any rate, the issue whether rhetoric is an art is dropped. The discussion comes to center around the question of what is power. According to Socrates, power is something good for him who has power. In other words, if you have a very man is very strong and cannot use his strength in any way for himself, he is not powerful. According to Polo, power is the ability to do what seems to be best to the individual concerned. And this, of course, is a beautiful thing because, as Socrates points out, something may seem to be good to a fool without being good for him. And therefore, to that extent, he has no power. Polos, in a sense, by a powerful man, a man who can kill, exile, impoverish, everyone he likes to kill, etc. You know, that's a vulgar notion of what a powerful man is. And he can make or break his other experiments. Being powerful means, according to that view, being able to do what one will. But, Socrates says, whatever we do for some purpose. And the purpose is that what we truly will. For example, we do not will primarily to kill, but we kill because we will some good for us and believe we can get that good by killing. But what is good for us, with a view to which we might kill or whatnot? The actions as actions are means and therefore neutral. They are done for the sake of ends, for example, wealth and other things which are good in themselves. Striving for wealth and doing what brings about wealth is therefore good, whereas mere killing is not good, because it may get us into trouble. Sensible men choose the useful things, not merely things which are spectacular. A man who can do everything but does not get what is good for him is, of course, not powerful. It is here tacitly denied that a reasonable man will ever do anything from a whim, for the fun of it, at random, for example, sitting down or rising, without a purpose. Just as he says, that is tacitly denied and abstracted from, and that is, of course, an important point we have to consider. At this point now, the dialogue makes a decisive turn. Polos is obviously dissatisfied and returns to his original assertion by giving it a personal character. Would you, Socrates, not wish to do in the city whatever you like? Or do you not envy people who can do what they like, making and breaking and so on? Socrates says, do you mean killing justly or killing unjustly? And he explains, killing unjustly is altogether bad. And killing justly is at best a distasteful, hence bad necessity. The good for the sake of which a reasonable man acts is justice, or at least compatible with justice. Hence, to suffer injustice, while this is an evil, is a lesser evil than doing injustice. These are the well-known themes of Socrates around this whole dialogue term. Polos, however, says, injustice and happiness are perfectly compatible. Socrates, killing is under no circumstances something good, and that means there are actions which are under all circumstances bad, which are under no circumstances neutral, like, looking at the watch. It may be a bad action under certain circumstances and may be a good act and other than others may be indifferent. Now, here we have this digression, if we analyze this thing, an implicit contradiction. All action conduces to the end, say well, are good. The alternative, certain actions are bad in all circumstances. That means that the highest consideration cannot be limited to the end, say wealth or whatever it may be, but concerns also the quality of the means. Now it is quite interesting that the first proposition, that all actions conducive to a good end are good, is made when Socrates is the questioner, while the other commonsensical view, that certain actions are bad in all circumstances, is made when Polus is the questioner or Socrates the answerer. Now, this second view, that certain actions are bad in all circumstances, corresponds to the ordinary understanding of justice. And this implies that Polus does not truly know what justice is, and according to the logic of the argument with Polus, he is an unjust man, because he doesn't know what justice is. Now, and of course, this also is very bad for Gorgias, because Gorgias has claimed his pupils will all be just. And now we see here a flagrant case of an unjust pupil of Gorgias. Gorgias is wrong in a... You see how the discussion with Polus throws light back on the discussion with Gorgias, and therefore how rightly the dialogue is called Gorgias, because they discuss this Polus, and later on the Qualitas illuminates the Gorgias effect. Gorgias is wrong in asserting or implying that rhetoric is necessarily just. The question which remains to be settled is, however, is rhetoric nevertheless quasi-omnipotent? I repeat that Socrates shows this all too Gorgias in the case of this pupil, Polus, using Polus as a kind of guinea pig. He does it all for the benefit of Gorgias. And now in the sequel he does something else. Socrates shows that he, and not Gorgias, teaches Polus justice. And therewith, according to that logic, makes him just, which we have to consider later. Now, Socrates, but we cannot merely read, we have to think while we read. Now, Socrates admits that suffering injustice is bad, very commonsensical view, and hence, killing justice in self-defense is of course all right, and surely better than to be killed unjustly. Yeah? But if self-defense is just, then of course forensic rhetoric may be just. Someone may try to kill you not by shooting at you, but by trapping you. There is a technical term for that. Railroading? Framing. By framing you. Now, if you are entitled to take cover when someone shoots at you, you are entitled to counteract the framing by forensic rhetoric. Forensic rhetoric must be just. This is not brought out here, and we must keep this in mind. In other words, the wholesale condemnation of rhetoric, which Socrates seems to propose, is irrational. And we have to find the reason why Socrates makes these extreme statements. Now Suvarez turns to refuting Polos's assertion according to which an unjust man may be happy or blessed. Before beginning with the refutation, he admits to Polos that Polos's view is the view of most men, including such pillars of society as Nietzsche's and Berkeley's for their family. You know that Polos has opinion on his side. Common opinion is immoral, or at the very least, not very strictly moral. Socrates renders his own view more precise by saying that the unjust men would improve their fate if they underwent punishment by gods and men. That's to say that an evil, that is spelled out very graphically, that an evildoer tortured to death while watching as his wife and children are tortured to death is happier than if, by escaping the torturer, he would become a tyrant and be, quote, happy, unquote, ever after. So that is a very paradox to them. And so when he says, yeah, but this is what all people, with the exception of me, think. Now, Polos claims that Socrates is crazy. Everybody would agree with Polos in rejecting Socrates' assertion. Socrates, however, claims that everyone would agree with him. So in other words, each claim that he stands for the common opinion of mankind. But Socrates asks a qualification. Everyone would agree with him if they were to argue the thing out dialectically, not rhetorically. Not arguing dialectically, everyone would agree with Polos. But in arguing dialectically, i.e. led by Socrates, everyone would agree with Socrates. In the sequel, Socrates proves at least this much, that Polos is compelled to agree with him. In a dialectical exchange, the cause of justice wins. Socrates exhibits the power of dialectics. In an argument between individuals, Socrates alone, Polos alone. Not in what would happen in a law court when you address an orator addresses the crowd. Its implication is the just man is lost before a jury. There we know a famous case of which the fifth Socrates must have thought, but surely the author of the project has thought, the case of Socrates. There is a, if you look up in the Gorgias 474a to b, and compare it with the Apology of Socrates 37a, you are in for a surprise. Because in the Gorgias, Socrates says he does not do a certain thing which he admits doing his apology, namely to have a conversation with a man. And Socrates calls his apology a conversation with the city of Athens, right, with a man. This is impossible. There is another difficulty, a graver difficulty. People may not be able to refute or to contradict the thesis of justice, according to which suffering injustice is better than doing injustice. They may nevertheless not be convinced by that failure. Polos refers to the consensus of all men in public assembly, and Socrates refers to the consensus of all men in dialectical exchange one with one. But Polos also refers to the consensus of all men in their feelings and Socrates to the consensus of all men in non-self-contradictory speech. In other words, if you think of this example of the man tortured to death, you remember that? Being his wife and children tortured to death and so, and under no circumstances, rather than escaping and becoming a tyrant. What Buddha says, that's the way in which people feel. And what Socrates implies is that they cannot maintain that in speech. Do you see the point, the difference? And it is, of course, then a question. What is truer? The feeling? Even if this feeling leads to self-contradiction when expressed, or the non-self-contradictory speech. In other words, the great question is how powerful is that non-self-contradictory speech? How powerful is rational speech? How powerful is reason? We have seen before that the dialogue suggests in different ways, in a Gorgian way and in a Socratic way, that there is a preponderance, not to say omnipotence, of logos. And here we see from the other side that this is a question. This hypothesis of the preponderance or omnipotence of logos will be tested in the Gorgian. And you see how this is connected with the particular problem of rhetoric, because rhetoric is, of course, not strictly rational speech, but it is, nevertheless, speech. And the power of, what is the power of speech compared with other things? With what other things you will see soon, in case you do not aim. And this has, of course, an ambiguity. Whilst in the immediate context it naturally refers to childhood, it can also mean something else. The first age of the world, you know, the childhood of the human race. Yes. Now let us stop here. You remember this very phrase, the first age occurs in this passage, in the second discourse, where he praises the state of the savages, remember? After he says. If this throws again light of the reason why we so question teleology. Maturity is not simply, i.e. in every respect, superior to childhood, which I believe everyone would admit. The question was only whether it is superior in the society respect, not in every respect. But this way of thinking which we so adopt leads eventually, of course, to the equality of all ages, babyhood up to the last decrepitude of a man over 100. Everyone thinking of the abominable, disgraceful actions of the students during the Persian War, when the Persians sided with the Persian king. Now, and they have, of course, a ready answer. It was not we or us that were the damned oligarchs who ruled these effects. A description which you remember perhaps from the third book, beginning of the third book of the poet.